Reel 3. Now, after Brooklyn, you were posted to the Central Flying School at Upavon. What sort of impression did this make on you as the first proper service establishment that you had served with?
Well, it was interesting to be on a really service station. And this service station, I might say, was a bit different to others in that it was a joint RNAS-RFC effort. The staff, the top of the staff was Godfrey Payne. His number two was RFC, but I can't... Godfrey Payne was RNAS, or Navy in any case. His number two, I've forgotten the name, but he was RFC. And then right through the whole thing, the staffing was jointly RNAS and RFC, and the pupils also were RNAS and RFC. I was posted to Bloater flight. Bloater is a BE-8, commonly known as a bloater for the simple reason that it's a development of the BE, which the development being to put a Gnome engine in it. The Gnome engine necessitated a deeper fuselage in the front. The deeper fuselage in the front gave it a fishy look, hence bloater. It was always known as a bloater flight. The OC flight was Brock, and the pupils in the flight were a mixed lot of RNAS and ourselves. Amongst the RNAS was young Irving, incidentally, who was one of the people I remember, who was the grandson, perhaps, of Sir Henry Irving. Very nice bloke indeed.
What sort of impression did he make on the flight to which you were attached? Was he a personality?
He was quite a personality, yes. And
why?
One of the great things about him was that he had a marvellous Indian motor bicycle, and that is a thing that everyone didn't have. And he and I used to go about together quite a bit. And we used to go wherever we were going on a compass course on his Indian motor bicycle. If we came to a mountain, we went straight over the top. If we came to plains, we went straight across the plains. And if we came to a farm gate, we went through the gate and across the thing and out the other end. But that was rather naughty, but I suppose people will be that age sometime or other.
Did he cause any other comment for any other reasons?
Yes, young Irving also had the poetic knack, which I suppose arose from his great-grandparent. But
what was the training you were given at Upavon like?
Well, we worked a normal 6-day week. Normally we broke off for the weekend, went home or something of that kind. Yes, I remember coming down back on the Sunday night train over and over and over again, where we met at the station with a Crossley tender. Crossleys were the things, of course, in these days. Apart from that, we did our ordinary day's work just the same as we do an ordinary day's work anywhere else. I had done 50 minutes at Brooklyn. I clocked in a total of 4 hours at CFS on bloaters, in the course of which I did my cross-country test, which was one of the things I'd gone down to do. And a bit laughable today, my cross-country test consisted of a job from Salisbury to Andover, which I successfully completed by means of following the railway line from Salisbury to Andover. We wouldn't call it much, but that was the cross-country test, and that was that.
This was supposed to have been a compass flight, was it?
No, not necessarily. I don't think one was particularly instructed in compass use of a compass, as far as I remember. It was simply a cross-country flight. You were told to go from A to B, and you went from A to B. And, a great deal of the finding one's way about was done by what we called Bradshawing in those days. A load of it. If you got to go to Newcastle, you probably went by Bradshaw. You followed railway lines to here, and a compass wasn't used a great deal.
Bradshaw was the railway guide.
Bradshaw was the railway guide, mm. Yes. Bradshawing was quite the recognised way of getting about. And so the fact of following the railway line from Salisbury to Andover was nothing out of keeping at all. Anyhow, I got to the stage of completing my time at Upavon, and I was posted overseas. And here is a thing for which they thought I was a hell of a squirt.
To what extent did you receive any formal flying instruction at Upavon?
Well, flying instruction at Upavon was exactly like all the flying instruction of its day. It was very simple and straightforward. It was simply what you learnt to do was to take the machine off the ground and put it back onto the ground again. For this reason, you were given circuits and bumps by your instructor until you were efficient at putting the machine onto the ground. He'd then say, go away for an hour, go away for a couple of hours, and put in a bit of time. You'd put in a bit of time getting accustomed to being in the air, and you'd come back, or you'd make a series of landings to practice your landing capability. The landing capability was the big thing. Anything in the nature of aerobatics or handling an aircraft in an awkward position simply was not known. Such things as a spin meant certain death. That was flatly that. And at the CFS time, at the time when I was at CFS, and nothing came into the ordinary scheme of instruction beyond perfectly plain, straightforward flying, and as I have mentioned, a cross-country flight, which is quite a joke.
How did you find inter-service relations were at Upavon, which was, as you've already pointed out, a two-service establishment for flying training?
Oh, we mixed up perfectly comfortably. Perfectly comfortably. One of my own special friends was Irving, as I've said. Then there was, no, not Hardcastle, but a name rather like that. He was a Navy type too, who was rather a friend of mine. And altogether we mixed up without any distinction.
Now, in June of 1915, you were posted to Dover. What was the purpose of this posting?
I don't, in my Brooklyn stuff and my CFS stuff, which Brooklyn's was Morris Farman's Longhorns and CFS was Bloaters, neither of which were service machines. And I was to go overseas, and I was then sent down to Dover for the precise purpose of qualifying on a machine which was still in service.
What did that involve?
Well, that involved further training at Dover and Dover sorting out what had best become of you. And the first thing, one of the things which they did at Dover was to convert people onto monoplanes, people who had been entirely biplanes, as I had. Convert them onto monoplanes. And that was converting onto monoplanes meant, in the main, that you were destined for a fighter squadron, because the fighter squadron were Marans and that sort of thing, in the main, were monoplanes. Non-fighting squadrons were very largely biplanes. And so the first thing that I was down for was conversion onto monoplanes. Now then, one had an instructor, of course, but the instructor simply told you what to do and you did the rest of it yourself. In a very similar way to what flying had been learned by the early people at Hendon and Brooklands and all those early places, where you'd learnt to taxi and then you'd learnt to take off, to do straights and that sort of thing. That method was still in force in Dover at the time when I went there. And there were two particular machines for conversion onto monoplanes. There were two particular machines that you handled to start with, both of them Blériot, as you know, is a warp wing monoplane. One of them had its wings clipped so short that it could not take off, and it was just used for taxiing practice, which was the first thing you had to practice. It was called a Penguin, and the other one had its wings clipped, but not to the extent that the Penguin had, and it was capable of doing straights. And so the first operation was, you were detailed onto the wall, the Penguin was detailed to you, whichever way you like to put it, And you practice taxiing up and down, round and round, this way and that and the other way, until you were sufficiently at home in handling the taxiing side of the machine. You then were considered to have qualified on Penguin and transferred to Virgin.
On Penguin, what kind of radius of, what kind of area was involved where you were taxiing over?
Oh, taxi over the whole airfield. You taxi round and round up the edges. You'd get into trouble if you taxied into the middle of the place where people were trying to land very naturally. But you taxi this thing round, more or less, just round the edge of the airfield, tiddling around the corners and giving a bit of a bat up the straight, the edge of the airfield, and tiddling around the corner again. Until you could then do a right-hand one and do a left-hand one and that sort of thing. You just do what you found necessary to do to get facile control of this Penguin from the taxiing angle.
Presumably, if you were doing this, there were some significant ways in which taxiing a monoplane was different from taxiing the biplanes you'd already had experience of.
Oh, no.
No difference?
No. There would be some sort of difference because the biplane has got much more wing surface and therefore is much more susceptible to side winds and that sort of thing, that is to say the biplane which one had been accustomed to, than the Penguin. The Penguin had got precious little wing surface and was not interfered with very much, was much more windproof and felt the wind, side winds and that sort of thing, very much less than the biplane which one had been accustomed to taxiing around the place. No, it was just a piece of more or less routine. Pass out on the Penguin. When you passed out on the Penguin, then you've reached a certain stage and you can go on the other one.
Can I ask you this? Would you say that the simplicity of ground flying, as it were, that you've just been describing, would be comparable to, say, driving a car around the ground?
Oh, yes.
How valid would that comparison be?
Oh, yes, much the same. You're getting your feet, instead of getting your feet accustomed to the accelerator and the brake which you've got in a motor car, all your feet are doing is tackling the rudder bar, and your hands tackling the throttle. That's all you're doing when you're learning a bit of taxiing. But you get, it's a matter of getting a little bit of knack. At what speed can you turn? You mustn't turn too fast or you'll turn the thing on her side and that sort of thing. Quite obviously, it's a very sensible thing to do a bit of taxiing practice. I don't think they do it nowadays, but I think the reason they don't do it nowadays is that taxiing modern machines around an airfield is so very, very, very simple. It doesn't want so much of a knack in doing it as these earlier ones.
Now, after you'd climatise yourself to the ground handling of the Penguin, you then moved on to the Virgin.
Then moved on to flying the Virgin.
Incidentally, was there any particular significance in the choice of names, Penguin and Virgin?
Penguin. Well, yes. Penguin sticks out a mile.
Yeah.
Bird that can't fly. So
the
he's
Virgin
automatically
is less obvious.
Well, the Virgin. There was the certain amount of discussion in the mess about the Virgin, and one school of thought said that because she'd never been broken, and the other school of thought said it was because she'd so often been broken. Which of those is true, I can't tell you. Anyhow, the Virgin she was.
Anyway, I interrupted you, though. You were talking about the Penguin.
Well, we've finished with the Penguin, and we've now got on to the Virgin. And in Virgin, she has the power, and that's where you taxi her down to the far end of the field, turned her nose into wind, gave her the gun, and flew into wind. And she had the capability of taking off from the ground. And you take her off and do a straight and put her down at the far end of the field. And that, again, was the ordinary method which had been used in pre-war days. But Hendon and Brooklands and those places where people learn to fly, and you just learn to fly straight.
After having flown biplanes before coming to Dover, did you notice any significant difference in the flying characteristics of monoplanes?
Yes. It's interesting as a fact that the biplanes which I had flown, or one of the biplanes which I had flown, the Bloater, was a warped wing job, and the Bleriot, of course, is a warped wing job as well. But as far as any particular difference in the flying feeling of a Bloater or this Bleriot, just doing a straight in a Bleriot does not possibly give you a sufficient impression of what difference there is between that and flying the Bloater, because your Bloater flying has been around the sky, full-blown flying, and your Bleriot experience is simply taking it off the ground for a few feet and flying for 100 or 200 feet and putting it down on the ground again. So there couldn't be any comparison between the two, actually.
Yes. Why was it that you weren't invited to do some rather less straightforward flying? Don't quite understand the sort of training logic behind this. Now, after doing straights, when did you get on to doing circuits, and was it with the same aircraft?
Well, that brings in a thing, it really does. The ordinary routine, of course, was first you learnt your taxiing in the Penguin, you then did your straights in the Virgin, you then were passed up onto a dual-control Bleriot, and you went and did your circuits. But unfortunately, before I got to that stage, I had been very naughty with the Virgin. And so my training came to an abrupt halt as far as...